Valley 104.9 goes behind the scenes with former King County Councilperson Kathy Lambert every Tuesday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 6 p.m. as part of Valley 104.9's Community Talk and Info Sundays.
All right. Thank you for joining us today with Behind the Scenes with Kathy Lambert on Radio Valley 104.9. And today we have an amazing guest with us, and that is Senator Keith Ettner from the 12th District. And so welcome, Senator. It's good to have you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start in on making sure that since you have a very new district that is expanded, that people know more about you. So we'll start with the basics. Define the borders of your district.
Well, the borders of our district is probably one of the more unique ones in the state in that it's on both the sides of the Cascades. So on the west side, the northwest corner is Monroe. And then we head down the Snoqualmie Valley to North Bend and Snoqualmie Parkway. And part of Snoqualmie is in the 12th, part is in the 5th. And then we head east to include most of Chelan County, with the exception of a little bit of Wenatchee, but it's pretty much the whole of Chelan County. And that's, it's a, when you look on the map, it's right in the heart of the state. And it's changed a little bit from when I started. When I first started in legislature, the district was Chelan and Douglas counties, a good part of Okanagan County and Grant County, up to the Canadian border over to Grand Coulee Dam. And you can see now that obviously the communities of interest are a little bit different than when I started, but it's been fun just getting to know new communities and new people.
Excellent. Well, you have a very interesting district, and it'll be interesting to see in the next redistricting after the year 2030 what your district will look like, because as you said, you're in the center, and as they were doing the redistricting, your district was sort of the elasticity. Oh, we'll move a little here, we'll move a little there. And so you definitely have a very broad district.
Well, actually, I would point out that I've actually been in three different districts. And in fact, we still have a court case that's pending that may, in fact, move the boundaries again back to where they were prior to this election. So I may end up with a whole other boundary line adjustment before the next election.
Would you tell us a little bit more about that case? Because it's so interesting and in some ways, in my opinion, a little bizarre that this is happening. And I did have a meeting the other day with Senator Tories. And so she has been explaining to me what she's going through as the senator from that area. So could you explain what's happening in the court right now?
Well, right now the court is considering an appeal to a judge's ruling that redistricted, changed the boundaries of the redistricting commission. And that redistricting commission, based on the most recent census, is a bipartisan commission. There's two Republicans, two Democrats. They had a very difficult time. And as you said, the District 12 was really the one that was the most dramatically affected, because they had to move 60,000 people from the west side of the state to the east side to make sure that you had the proper proportion in each district. And consequently, there was a voting rights project out of UCLA, of all places. Felt like the Yakima area had not been done correctly. It didn't give ample representation, and primarily for Latinos. And so the judge ruled, yeah, you need to redo that. And if you look at the map of those districts down the 14th, 15th, and 16th, if there was ever a case for gerrymandering, that would be it. And so they redid all of those and affected, the 12th, the 13th, the 7th, and others along the way, the 9th. And so that's why there's an appeal to that judge's ruling. And interestingly enough, as Senator Torres, told you, she was actually redistricted out of her district. If the court reverses the previous decision, she'll be back in her district. But, and here she is, the Latina, that is almost disenfranchised. And so, and as the elections unfolded, the change really did not materialize as they anticipated. And so they're still, represented by, the same party, the Republicans, down in that area.
It's been very interesting to watch. And as you said, the redistricting committee had a very difficult time. hopefully that the next redistricting committee, the people on it, can be a little more collaborative, attend all the meetings like they were supposed to. I understand there were some attendance issues that didn't help that process. So you have a very changing district. And I remember when my district changed, there were people who I'd represented for nearly two decades who would say, I'm sorry, you're still my representative regardless. And then new people are, who are you? And so trying to get the relationships with the new people and to be able to say that people are no longer mine officially, but they'd adopted me and I'd adopted them. So it was a very interesting dance of getting everybody to know that the boundaries have changed, and that happens every 10 years. So you've moved from the House to the Senate. What do you find different in the Senate from the House?
Well, it's there. The dynamics of the way things operate, you know, even from the whole process, is just different. And the Senate seems to have a little more decorum, a little better organized. The time management is better. In the House, there are often times where no one really seems to know, you know, what the schedule was going to look like. And here in the Senate, it's run so much differently. So it's just a sense, a different feel. The committees are, you know, half the size. So the relationships you develop with the other committee members is, you know, you have a better opportunity to get to know who you're really serving with. And it just, as I said, the dynamics are just have a different feel to it.
And I think you said one of the magic words about governing is relationships. And I really noticed a huge difference in relationships on the King County Council when we were together every day. And then during COVID, so many things slipped by that wouldn't have slipped by had everybody been together and having what they call water cooler conversations and conversations in the hall and in the elevator about what do you think about this and that. So having the relationships and talking to each other is so important. So I'm glad that you're finding that to be a real help to you too. The next question I wanted to ask you is there is a bill in the Senate and it has a companion bill in the House, and that is the parental rights bill. And in the House, it's bill 1296, and in the Senate, it's 5181. So can you tell us what you think is going to happen to the parents' rights bill when it is brought up in the Senate?
Well, I'm sure we'll have a pretty robust debate because really what we're doing is changing what the legislature did last session when the initiatives came forward. This was one of the three that the legislature decided to act on and not go to the actual ballot. So it did put in place a lot of notification standards that had not been there. And now this bill will undo what we did last year. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we can, I guess my hope is that we can defeat it and stay with what we have, because the whole idea is to make sure that parents are able to have a good understanding of what is happening to their child when they leave their home and they're put in the care of the school system. And this has to do with academic records. It has to do with medical records. It has to do with some of the physical interactions. I mean, even the, you know, the assault type things, there's a criminal element in there that parents would not necessarily be notified if things happen to their kids in a timely manner, what I consider a timely manner. And so I'm hopeful that, as I said, we can have a good debate and we'll be able to you know, really analyze the bill for what it is, and hopefully we will defeat it.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And the listeners to this podcast have been hearing over and over about making their voices heard on that bill and how deceptive it was last year to pass it, knowing full well that they were going to come back this year and do that. And the new amendment that was put on that says that if a school employee molests a child, that the parents do not need to be notified for at least 48 hours. That is just something that I think is abhorrent. And I think that that's kind of an issue that doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat, not informing parents of a child's situation at school that is that difficult is just not okay. So really, really important that people let their representatives know, and also to thank people like you that are willing to stand up and say no. The existing law that was put into effect last year with the support of so many citizens collecting signatures on the initiative is what we need to keep. Are there any bills right now before the legislature that are of particular interest to you or concern you?
Well, one that really concerns me, and it's in the one of the committees I'm in, the Housing Committee, has to do with, they're calling it rent stabilization, but it basically is rent control. And it has a lot of restrictions or a lot of burden that you're placing on the housing provider, the person who owns that unit. And I think that it's really important, just on principle alone, to let the market play out. And, you know, people need to be held accountable for the way they treat others. And we do have, you know, plenty of guidelines within our landlord-tenant acts that we've modified over the last few years. And it made it more and more difficult for people to provide that housing as a provider. And, you know, so if you're a landlord and you have a unit that or units that you're providing, we should be doing all we can to make sure that those units are still available. And what these kinds of things have done in other places where you're trying to control what you can do, it really drives people out of the market, and particularly the smaller people that, they don't have a lot of control over the expenses that happen in it. You know, they got a couple of units, maybe you have something that, you know, impacts you dramatically. And, you know, if you do need to raise the rent because you have to at least, you know, make your expenses that property incurs, you know, I don't believe that the government should be in the position where they're telling people what they can or can't do as far as providing that service, because, you know, people do have the option of staying there or not. And I think we've gotten to the point where we don't have the appreciation for people that are willing to get into that rental market. And so I'm hopeful that this bill can also be defeated, because it seems to me just a stretch. And also it's proven in other areas to not be effective. In fact, it's actually been detrimental.
Yes, I totally agree. I was a landlord at one point, and a good landlord. My tenant called and said they needed something. The very next day it was being handled, if not sooner. And yet they left me 786 pounds of garbage when they left. And I decided at that point, I don't think I want to be a landlord anymore. And that's unfortunate, because somebody has to be the landlord and also make sure that they're taking care of their property. So thank you for watching out for both landlords and tenants to make sure that there is available housing stock, and also looking at how we can increase the housing stock by removing some of the regulations that are keeping us from being able to build and have the available housing that we need across the state. Is there any concern in any particular bill that you think needs to be addressed?
Well, we have a number of bills in the committees I'm on. I mean, in housing and local government are two of them, and they're both dealing with probably, you know, housing supply, the land use. And so I'm watching a lot of those things. Actually, I have a number of bills that are creating opportunities for people to build more housing units. And so, you know, we've had a Growth Management Act that's been in place for 30 years, and it was all done with the idea that we're going to control growth, and we had these 13 goals, and we've actually added on to those basic goals. And so all local governments have to plan, and they're supposed to be meeting these goals. And what we've done is made it very difficult, and we're continuing to do that in putting restrictions on the flexibility that I think each community ought to have in their planning to meet the needs of their community. And so that whole idea that we're going to all plan, you know, kind of in the same manner, it doesn't really work well. And we've seen that. That's one of the reasons why I think we have such a housing shortage. So some of these bills that are coming through the Housing Committee and local government, they're well intended. But the reality is that if you can't get beyond the restrictions that you have, we don't, kind of reevaluate what we put in place that are actually the impediments to building and why people are not able to develop, we're not going to be moving the needle at all toward creating more housing supply. So I'm concerned about, you know, how we're approaching things and not taking the more global look at some of these bills that are coming. They're kind of piecemeal bills. And it makes people feel like, yeah, we are addressing, you know, an issue, but it's going to be very minuscule, I guess, the difference that it's going to make. And we need to be having real serious conversations of what is it that's that's holding us back? Why aren't we able to build more? Whether it's some of the labor issues that we have. I mean, what the, you know, if you talk to anyone, they'll say that building a unit today is just, it's almost cost prohibitive. And then you try and drill down, well, what is it that's driving up the cost? And if they say, well, prevailing wage, but I think we should have prevailing wage. Well, that's the trade-off that you get when you pay more, you know, and you kind of artificially put in place what your labor costs will be. That has to be factored in. And so then the square footage price per unit has continued to climb. And we've got supply issues. We've got, you know, you go on down the line, the environmental permits that are coming into play with a number of places that you want to develop and they're not able to. I mean, we have to be willing to make, as I said, some trade-offs and still, you know, maintain some sort of understanding of protecting, you know, sensitive areas. But we have to be able to be intellectually honest of what's really holding us back as far as making progress in making a dent in that housing supply deficit.
So you really hit the nail on the head. It's all those things, including the idea that the cost of all the regulations, like you said, getting the permits. And I know that there was many examples where people would come into the county and say things like, "Well, I'm not changing the footprint, but they're making me do a study about the footprint." And so it was regulation for the sake of regulation rather than it was really needed. And some of those studies had 20 and 30 and 40,000 or more to the cost of the housing. I was at a meeting about 2 months ago with a bunch of planners, and I mentioned to them the fact that in the Growth Management Act, one of the provisions is that all of these goals need to be in balance and that you need to have a certain amount of housing stock in each category. And if you're not in imbalance, that you need to adjust in the goals and how you implement them. But that is in King County, for instance, that has not been done. We have not moved the growth management line. We have shrunk it only by a couple of acres, but it's been shrunk over those 30 years, as opposed to lots more people are coming. And what is that going to be? And during COVID, when people started realizing they could work from home, that they didn't want to be cooped up in the house with no garden, no place to take the dog when they couldn't get out. And so the need for housing, the kind of housing, I went to a senior housing project and there were 20 internal stairs in this house. And I'm like, a senior citizen does not need 20 internal stairs. So, you know, looking at what is appropriate housing for the different aging groups, what are our demographics, is really important. So I'm really glad that you're looking at the Growth Management Act to see what has worked and what hasn't worked. And for a long time, because it was almost sacred that you couldn't change anything in the Growth Management Act because it was sacred. And after 30 years, it needs to be evaluated again. So thank you for being brave enough to go into that. One of the main issues in any governing body is the budget. And that is really the best document for telling what people value is where you put your money. So are there any issues in the budget that you're particularly interested in having in the budget or particularly interested in not being in the budget?
Well, there are a number of things that I don't believe need to be in there that we've added. We've put on a number of commissions that, you know, they start to take on a life of their own, and that would be just, you know, a small issue, but it would certainly help. But the concerns that I have about the budget is when a government creates an expectation of a service, we need to be able to fund that service before we, you know, are creating more things. So, and I'm referring specifically to Medicaid. And when we're asking housing, I mean, healthcare providers to provide a service that we don't adequately compensate for, then it's important that we really take a good hard look at it. What is it that we're expecting? If we're going to ask somebody to provide health care, then we better make sure that we're actually paying them what it costs them to provide that health care, or else that health care goes away. And I'm thinking particularly of, you know, rural health care situations where you know, we may be losing facilities because it really is a challenge. But you know, that it certainly is one of the things, the social services that we have in place that we have a tremendous, you know, there's the drugs, culture that's there, the homelessness, the mental health. I mean, there's so many things that we are doing. We're really not getting to the heart of the issue, and yet we're spending more and more money. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think we have to really prioritize, what we're going to spend on, and then make sure that what we're spending the money on is actually effective. Are we getting a return on our investment? And we've got enough of a track record to determine what programs are working, which ones are just there, and we just keep putting money forward. And that's just in the operating, budget, where there's things that, as I said, I think, we need to be focusing on. The budget that I'm sitting on, being a part of the whole process, is on transportation. And to me, that is one of those fundamental core functions of government, is to make sure that we have an infrastructure. It's not something the private sector is going to do. I mean, that's what the governments are put in place for, whether they be local or state. And right now we are looking at a significant budget deficit that we're trying to plan for. And I think that that's something that has to really be addressed. And we are working through that. We will continue to work at it for a number of weeks yet before we actually come up with the budget. But we have, roads and bridges, the ferries, I mean, you name it. I mean, we are falling $1.5 billion a year behind in maintenance costs, and what really needs to be done in order to ensure that we have, a stable and consistent delivery of those services. So there's a lot going on, and that's what we're really at the kind of the core of our work right now is taking a look at the budgets and reestablishing priorities. But it is it's a real challenge.
I know a number of years ago, Seattle did a study on their human service contracts to see how many of the provisions in their contracts were actually fulfilled properly. And I don't remember the percentage, but let's just say the word dismal is a good description of what they found. And I found that also in contracts at the King County level, that a lot of the contracts were not being fulfilled and became very political. So I think it's important, especially in transportation. And the county has a bridge maintenance report. And when it would arrive on my desk, I would just be like, oh, no, not again. I got to read this horrible report. It makes me sick every time I read it, because so many of the bridges were in need of repair that were very old. And it used to be that the bridges were all on a approximately 50-year cycle, where the feds would pay 80% and then the local and state would pay the other 20. And then those formulas changed. And I think that that's really serious, that people don't understand how badly some of our bridges are in need of repair. I also noticed that you're on the JLARC committee.
I am. And that is it's a committee that does some good work as far as studying. The unfortunate thing is oftentimes the studies, we don't follow up with them. So, I mean, they are doing accountability. It is an audit committee. And I would like to think that we could be more effective with that. But I do appreciate being there, being able to answer the questions. Kathy, as you well know, sometimes your schedules get really backed up. And
yes.
I'm kind of at a point where I do have to run to another meeting. But
I appreciate that you stayed as many minutes as you did. And I hope that the people that are in your district will know you a little bit better. If they want to help you or be on your newsletter, how is the best way to be informed about what you would like them to do as your army of getting things done?
They can just email keith.gaynor@ledge.wa.gov. And just, you can get on that newsletter. In fact, we just sent out our first newsletter, and they'll be coming out periodically. So they can just go to my website. Like I said, it's just Senator Keith Gaynor, and they can sign up for that newsletter. But
thank you so much.
I hope we get a chance to talk again.
You let me know when you'd like to do it, and we'll do it. Have a great day.
Yeah,
thanks for your service.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we just heard from the senator, and you are very lucky if you are in his district, and all of us are lucky because he brings a voice of reason to the entire state. I met him many, many years ago when I was serving on a committee that was one of the best committees I've ever served on, And it was the Washington State Association of County Officials, WASAC. And on this committee, we had people from all over the state, obviously. And we did not talk about what party we were from. We would come in and talk about what are the issues that were happening in our county. We would share, we'd eat pizza, sometimes too much pizza, and just have a relationship. And people would say, "Are you really from King County? Because you understand farming." And I would say, "Well, yes, we have farms in Eastern King County and in part of my district." And so as well. And so I actually put a tour together where I brought over legislators from the other side of the state to show that yes, King County and this side of the state does care about farming. And so I was able to build relationships with the farmers. And also, there had been some issues with the people on one side of the state not liking King County. And to be honest with you, there were many reasons they didn't like King County. One of the council members had said at a meeting very clearly, "We're the biggest county. We don't care what you think. And so we'll just tell you what we want," which did not build relationships. So when I was assigned to that committee, I made it very clear that I knew that that was the previous view of how things were handled and that that was not going to continue. So that was really an important committee. And on that committee was Keith. And Keith was a solid, studied, a really good thinker, and got along with everybody. He was just a delight. And I never asked what party anybody was on that committee because we just didn't do that. And I thought it was wonderful that we were able to have such camaraderie and leave the party out of it, but bring in the issues and the concerns and build bridges, literally and figuratively. So I have known Keith for a very long time, the senator, and I am very thankful that he is in the role that he is and that he will be able to bring that voice of reason now from being a commissioner to a representative and now on to a senator. So let us take a break and we will be back.
You're listening to Valley 104.9, your station for Valley talk and information.
If you want the hardest hitting headlines on the greatest threats we collectively face, tune in to the commercial free Global Alert News Hour, Sunday nights at midnight after musical star streams right here on Valley 104.9 FM.
Do you want the latest updates and trends on our local real estate market right here in the Snoqualmie Valley? Hey friends and neighbors, Buddy Buck here with eXp Realty. Tune in to our Snow Valley Real Estate Update right here on Valley 104.9 FM every Monday at 8:20 a.m. and 5:20 p.m. and also Saturday at 8:20 a.m. We'll cover the latest stats, trends, and insights for our current real estate economy, keeping you informed and ahead of the curve. Buddy Buck, peace.
So we had a great interview with Senator Gettner from the 12th District. And as you heard him describe, he has a very, very large district. And the boundaries of which have been changed several times and may potentially change again because of the suit on the Yakima area. And so it's very difficult to do redistricting. And that's obviously why there were so many problems. But I do believe that redistricting should be looked at by as many possible, keeping counties together, keeping cities together, being on one side of the mountains and on the other. As a community, having part of your district on one side of the mountains and the other makes it very difficult when it's snowing and weather conditions. And so I think some of the issues that were not addressed in the last redistricting need to be more of a focus in the next redistricting. And for there to be a little more nonpartisan look at exactly what all the elements should be. I realize that, you know, everybody knows that this district's more Democrat, this is more Republican. And, you know, balancing that out is important too. But it really needs to have a lot of other factors brought in. And some of the things that are happening during this lawsuit, and the idea was that a minority party was not well represented, when in fact the party that they said wasn't well represented is the nationality of Senator Torres, which is kind of a very interesting conundrum for her and for the people in the area. So the district boundaries change about every 10 years, maybe 11, because you have to get the census and then you have to get it all worked out with the boundary review committee and, you know, and then it implemented. So it's a long process, it's a tedious process, but it's a very, very important process. So if you are new to the senator, he's very easy to get to know. He's very personable. He's a great listener. He's intelligent. And so I have always enjoyed working with him. And it's been for over a decade. So I've always been impressed. And I think you will be too. He also believes, much like I do, on the idea that once you're elected, you represent everybody and want to hear what it is that needs to be changed. He did mention the Growth Management Act, which is very, very important. I mentioned in that interview that I had been to a planners meeting, and some of the planners said that they didn't realize that it actually said in the act that the adjustments need to be made when you have any of the provisions of the act that are not in balance. And certainly having a 300,000 in King County alone housing shortage by their projections shows that there is not proper balance in getting the housing created. And part of that has to do with available land and, you know, how do people want to live? Do people want to live in multi-story buildings? How high do you want it to be? Three stories, five stories, eight stories, 10 stories? You know, how many? And I think for some people during COVID, that their idea of how they want to live changed a little bit. And so are we providing the housing stock that will meet the future? I know there was a time where people were thinking apartments, very, very tiny, very, very tiny housing was a great idea. And that blew over also pretty quickly because it was too small for many people. In certain areas, maybe next to a college or a hospital where there's a lot of doctors that are mostly at the hospital and, you know, even at the legislature. I know when I rented apartments in Olympia, the landlord would say, "We love renting to legislators because you're never here. We know where to find you and you take good care of our units." And so in that situation, we didn't need a lot of space, but it was because we were at work for so many hours. So there are places where they could be useful, but there, as for a family or people who have animals and they want more space, that's not really the housing stock. So looking at what is the housing stock is really, really important. And then, of course, the time to permit. And now that we have seen in LA what's happened with the fire and how many housing needs there are there, the president has said that he is going to waive a lot of the federal requirements because these are not speculative buyers. These are people who have owned their home and now it's gone. And basically they want to rebuild what they had or better, being that some of the homes were older. And so I know that when I was building my house, the inspector said, "It's clear that you are intending this to be your house for a long time because you're not cutting any corners at all, and quite the contrary." And I said, "Yes, that is true. We intend to live here for 30 years, and we are now into the 40 years in this house." So the same thing I think will be true in LA. These people will rebuild their homes, and they will do so with quality. There won't be spec houses that are put up very, very quickly without thoughts for safety and other issues that are important when you build your home. So getting the housing stock built is important, and seeing how we can deal with some of the regulations in such a way that they don't add a third or a fourth or whatever in the cost of building the house and being able to get more houses available for people. I am very thankful that the senator is on the JLARC committee. I chaired that committee for a while, and it was very interesting to look at the regulations and if they were in fact authorized by law. Sometimes the agencies would get a little liberal on their idea that if I was allowed to do these five things, I'll just write in the law I can do 10 things. And so reining back on some of the agencies saying, no, 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 the law did not give you authority to do 6 through 10. So you need to fix this. And the number of committees and re-looking at committees, even in King County, there's a hate and bias committee. Do we really need a hate and bias committee? Are there other committees that could do that same function? Is $150,000 a year the right amount of money to put into that committee? And whether you like the committee, you don't like the committee, every committee should be evaluated at least every couple of years to say, is this committee relevant to today? Is this committee produce the things we wanted it to produce? And really looking at those costs. There are so many statewide task forces and committees. And I, at one point, realized that there were so many reports that very few people were actually reading the reports that were being produced. And so is that actually what needs to happen? And how can we say, much like they do in the law, that you can only produce in a brief so many pages? And is it more efficient to have a 30-page report as a maximum and have people synthesize what goes on, or a 5,000-page report? And so you have every little detail that could possibly come up. And I would say that the very, very, very long reports, which there were many, really didn't get the readership that a 30-page succinct report got. And so if there was something in the 30-page report that I wanted to know more, I could call the writers of the report and say, okay, I'm interested in this aspect. Can you send me more information or tell me more information on this? Or here are my concerns. Help me understand whatever the issue was. So, you know, really looking at how efficient our government is and how much, quote, quote, busy work is being done that actually may not need to be done. He brought up bridges, and I think that's really important to know that our bridges are not in good condition all across the country, largely because the feds changed the formula of going through and being proactive in knowing which bridges across the country were up to the 50-year mark, which bridges had safety concerns by their own investigations, and really looking at making sure on the 80-20 formula that the federal government was keeping the bridge and road constructions across the country. Talking, of course, now on bridges, which used to be separate from the roads. And when they put that together a number of years ago, I did go back to DC and say I didn't think that was a good idea. And I think that they did it anyway. And it's now been proven that it wasn't a good idea. So anyway, those are some of the things that were brought up in our interview. And again, if you don't know your senator, please make an opportunity to get to know him, read his newsletter. You can go online and see him in committees, see how he's contributing in the very important committees he serves on. And I think, you know, knowing your senator and appreciating the work that he does. He also has a new House member. And so we will be interviewing the new House member so that people will get to know him. The House member is new to the legislative process, but not new to serving the people of the 12th district, because he was a sheriff in the district. So many of you already know his service and know his work ethic and concern for the community. So we'll be interviewing him also so that you will get to know the new legislators. And as he said, the districts may change again. So as they change, these may be your senators and House members. And so it's always good to know people on various committees, know people that are good public servants. And I think that's what we have with these gentlemen that were elected in the last election. So with that, we will stop for today. And again, as there are more and more bills that have been dropped, as they call it, in Olympia, there are over 1,000. And so there's lots of debate, concerns, and questions going on. And I think if you have ideas, and there are many listservs that scan the different bills of the day, you can get on leg.wa.gov, leg.wa.gov, and see what the bills are of the day, both that have been dropped as new, and most importantly, the ones that are up for committee hearings. Although the ones that are dropped are just as important, because you want to know in advance if there's something coming that you have great concerns about or expertise. If you do have expertise in a topic, it is good to let your legislator or the committee chair that that bill will go to, that you have a particular expertise, so that they can glean any questions that they may have need answers from you. And I always found that that was very helpful to know who in my district or state, when I was in the state legislature, could be a resource and check things out, because sometimes there's bias in what the staff might say, even though there's not supposed to be. And so having experts tell me that this part needs to be reevaluated was very, very helpful. So get to know your legislators and what's happening in Olympia. There's a lot of things happening that are of concern to many people. So as I said about the listserv, finding groups that you agree with that you can get on their listserv, where they will tell you what bills they're concerned about. And then if you have input, you can do that either by emailing to the legislator or also calling the famous 800 number, 1-800-562-6000. Again, 1-800-562-6000. And letting your legislators know exactly how you feel about various bills. They do get a count on a regular basis of who's called in on a number of issues. And one of the legislators told me recently that she's very surprised that not very many people are calling in. And I don't know whether it's because people are so busy or people are just disgusted that some of the things that have happened already, like taking away some of our parental rights, is moving and people are feeling very frustrated. It was good to hear that the senator will work to stop the gutting of the initiative that they voted to approve last year in a very deceptive manner, knowing full well that that was their plan to gut it this year, which is very disheartening to me. So, those are the things that I wanted to go over from this interview. And again, I hope that you feel like you know the senator better after this interview. Have a great night.
Kathy will be back next week with another new episode of Behind the Scenes right here on Valley 104.9 Northwest Eclectic.